Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's like the famous thing. Being famous is not an end game, and doing a show is not an end game. Mm. You know, that should not be a goal as to, I want to do a show. It's like, well, you have to know why you're doing a show and what is the show going to give back to you at the end of it.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 41. For those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, TV, and today, performance. The boy with tape on his face, also known as Sam Wills, is a New Zealand prop comic who currently works out of London. So he's been a former street performer and currently tours the comedy circuit with a silent mime slash prop comic comedian app. It's really hard to explain, and we get into why it's so hard to explain and why that has been turned into actually one of his most valuable marketing assets. He has a lot to say on goal setting and trying to achieve your goals through the system, but while not letting it rule what you want to do. And I really enjoyed chatting to him. I think he's a very clever man, and I think he's really good at what he does, and he's really intelligent in the way that he handles his career and his future. We also go into what he wants out of the future and how he thinks he's going to achieve it using his current status. I think he's got some great thoughts on audience building and building a relationship with that audience, both online and offline, as well as using the different circuits for your own goals and achievements. And yeah, I really enjoyed chatting to him. I think this is a great episode. If you are enjoying the podcast and you'd like to support me and you would like, maybe you'd like to read a how-to guide for performers on building their own audiences and becoming sustainable around a community of people that support what they do, well, you're in luck. I sound like such an infomercial, but you're in luck. I have a book out at the moment. You can find a link for it in the show notes. It's on Indiegogo and it is being crowdfunded at the moment. It's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free. It's £5 for a digital copy or £8 for a paperback copy. There's loads of little deals in there. If you could support me that way, that'd be great. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. Just share this podcast with someone or leave it a review. Either way, every little bit helps. So please, please do anything you want to support out this podcast. Every little bit helps. Without any more delays, this is the boy.
So I'm trying to think, when did I first? Yeah, there's a fan of the show in Edinburgh who one show just turned up and gave me an envelope, which was just a picture. And it's like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then over the years, it's like, she's now those pictures are hanging on the wall in our house kind of thing. It's great.
So like every year she gives you a new picture?
Well, we end up, actually my wife commissioned her to do a picture. And I commissioned her just the other month to do another picture for a work proposal. So
that's amazing.
Good. Yeah, no, it's good. But then she's, you know, and she's genuinely a lovely person. So it's
It's like, with Twitter, like we were talking about before. I've met people off of there. Like some people have come down to previews or spots and stuff.
Yeah.
And like if they come back a couple of times, you sort of feel, not obligated, but you feel like it's a good idea to talk to them anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you do become friends.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with you being friends with someone who likes what you do.
Yeah, totally. You have to be able to separate to a degree some of the stage stuff to being a normal human being. Mm. Like I hate the people who do not talk to their fans, and the ones who have the ego to not do it, to hide away and run to a car kind of thing after the show. It's just stupid. You have to talk to your fans.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll tell you what, is that roughly where we're going to be holding the mic? Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah, that's cool. That's fine. I think we're safe to start. Although that is going to annoy me, it's okay.
Edinburgh sounds of construction.
Yeah, I'll just mention it in the intro and be like, we asked them to fuck off, but they pricks. Really quickly, what I normally do is I ask the first question and then I ask the person to answer the first question within the answer. So okay. I sort of do an intro and then you're... So, like, okay, so the first question was going to be, like, how many versions have there been of the boy?
Oh, okay.
So yeah. If you could sort of say, well, there have been X number of versions over the years, or do you know what I mean? So you answer the question within the answer.
Yeah, okay, got it.
How many versions of the boy have there been? It's really awkward to repeat it, isn't it?
Isn't it, yeah. I think with my show, I'm lucky enough in the sense that I think there's only been one version of the boy. Actually, no, that's not true. There's three. Yeah, I say there's definitely three versions because I... Oh, no, I'm going to add more. There's five. There's maybe... Now I'm thinking about them. Yeah, there's the first... The first evolution of the boy with tape on his face was the one who didn't have tape on his face. And so that was just the boy. And so that was done in New Zealand. And that was a character who just wore a funny little outfit because I wanted to do a silent character because I did another show where I talked a lot. So my silent character initially wore a little suit jacket, jeans, a black shirt, and a tape measure as a tie. And that was my little wacky tilt. So I did that show. So that's the first version of the boy. And then the second one had tape on his face. Because I end up ruining the first one by talking to the audience and ruining the act. So the second one had tape on his face and was more Tim Burton influenced with the stripy tops, because then I started realising I should have a nod to mime, and so the stripes went in there. Then it was grey jeans and black shoes, and then it evolved to the tidy version, which sort of stuck with me for a number of years. So we're up to three versions now. So that was the one that I stuck around and did the most shows with. So that was the boy with tape on his face touring through New Zealand and Australia, eventually coming over here to Edinburgh, and then he started getting revamped again. So I'm going to sit on four. There are four versions of the boy with tape on his face, and the current version has evolved again, who's become a wee bit darker and a wee bit more demon-esque.
Right.
Yeah.
And is that because you need to keep reinventing it for yourself, or do you think it's like the audience want something new? Or?
I think the audience definitely wants something new, and I also... Yeah, you're right, I do have to keep it interesting for myself, because the version number three, Tape Face 3, Tape Face 3 I've been doing for, 6 years, fairly solidly now, all over the place, and so I think I kind of run its course of where I thought the character could go. So only in developing and growing a new sort of brain of the character, or reinventing how the character thinks, makes me then go back over my old material and go, oh, I can do this completely different. And it's rediscovering the material again, and the jokes and the character. It's almost like the character, yeah, he gets the script again and he rereads it and performs it in a different way, which is really fun.
So is it just a complete character that isn't anything to do with you, or do you think it's part of you?
Oh, there's definitely a side. I say it's me at 9 years old. That would be a fairly solid base of the character, because I think the part of me that is very quiet, wanting to just watch people, and is a bit of a kind of social outcast in its own weird way, and then the ongoing playfulness. Like, I think that's something I carry through really strongly in my real life as well, is that I think people have forgotten how to play, and it's really important to me for maintaining my imagination. I force myself every day to imagine things, because it's a muscle that you have to keep in really good shape. So you must always imagine things all the time. So it's important to do that.
Can I see something really quick? I'm just going to check something. Yeah, it's fine. Sorry, because it clipped for a second. I was wondering what it was. It's fine. Just to make sure the sound's fine, because the thing is, your sound is way more important than mine, because I can re-record my end of it. I can come out here and re-record me.
Phone it in.
But you, I don't want to bring you back. And go,
bring it back in.
Tell me about Tape Face 3 again.
Say the word 3.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just need you to say tape again. Well, yeah, so why silent, though? Like, is it just you were trying to go the opposite way to every other comedian?
No, it was genuinely because I was going against myself. My old show was, I was called Sam Wills, that was my normal name, and I was doing stand-up comedy in New Zealand, but I was always a prop comic because I come from a circus background, so my circus background led me into circus sideshow of hammering nails up my nose and pushing my body through tennis rackets, and that got me into prop comedy back in New Zealand. And so for quite a long time, I was the only prop comic. I was very influenced by people like Jim Rose, Circus Sideshow, so my style of comedy was a lot of fast talking and a lot of tricks. And so I put together a show at the time, which was an evolutionary show called Dance Monkey Dance, The Evolution of Sam Wills, and essentially telling the audience about how I came to be the way I am, of being, you know, the nails and drills and broken glass and the oddities.
And this is when you were talking.
This was when I was talking. Okay. So I did a full 1 hour sort of interactive theatre comedy show. And at the end of the show, it finished with me. I won an award in New Zealand. It was at the time the biggest award in comedy, called the Billy T. James Award.
Wow.
And from that award, everyone just expected me to talk more and do more tricks, which kind of defeated the whole purpose of the show, because I was trying to explain to people how I was being forced to talk more and do more tricks by the audience. So I did, and that I really didn't want to do that, but they were making me do it because I was their dancing monkey. So no matter what I did, it was never going to be good enough, because they would always want more talking and more tricks. And so the idea was then to, everyone expected me to write another show of more tricks and more talking, and so the idea came about, well, I'll do the complete opposite, because I'm a rebellious idiot as well. That's maybe the street performer in me, who goes fight against the system, hate all sorts of authority. Yeah, and I've got a real chip on my shoulder about that.
At the time, did you have management?
No, not in New Zealand. You know, at the time, nobody in New Zealand had management. We only had one comedy club. 4 million people, one comedy club.
Right, that's interesting in itself. Because I was going to ask, what did your management think about you going against what was obviously commercially viable at the time?
In New Zealand, it's very different, because everyone's really encouraged to just try anything. Like with me and the comedy club, Scott Blanks at the Classic, he was really good, because I could almost ring him on the day and say, I've had an idea for a routine, can I get on the show tonight? And he would get me 5-10 minutes in a show, which is unheard of in this country. You just cannot jump onto a show. It's impossible.
So, unless you're
a decent name, going, let me swan in and do this. So that was really lucky. And then comedians are always taught, you know, we were all encouraged to try different things, try improv, try stand-up, try musical comedy, just try everything. So that way we'd always have a broader idea of what audiences understood about comedy and what we understood about comedy. So I do think they sort of fold into each other as well. Like, I know that my old days of writing stand-up material has come into doing silent comedy, because I'm using the same structures and gags and formats. Like, they're all the same sort of tools. It's just how you use them, really.
That's it. So, sorry.
Sorry to rewind and go back. What did management think? There was, no management.
Right. Yeah, that's the short answer. Now I've got, like, 4 more questions.
Good.
You just opened up a can of worms there. Okay. Let's quickly answer this. Right, so no one has management in New Zealand.
Oh, no, they do now, because at the time, New Zealand comedy wasn't so big. We were doing well. Our comedy club was happening. We were doing university tours and that sort of thing. But then comedy got very cool, thanks to people like Flight of the Conchords. So that became great. And then television started happening in New Zealand. So there was a TV show that just started called 7 Days, and it kind of just made comedians cool. So, and it's still going now. Comedy is very cool. It's like one of the number one shows in television in New Zealand. So then suddenly people started getting management. There was a couple of people popped up and said, I'm going to be a manager of comedians. And so, there's, I think, 3 agents in New Zealand. And that's enough.
Yeah.
So, because, the scene is, the comedy club, the Classic, is open enough that you don't need management to get a gig there. You just need to have enthusiasm. And Scott's almost like the management to everyone. It's like he's there just to encourage comedy, because he loves comedy. Like, he's not, well, only my comics can work here. He's just, everyone's allowed a gig. So, yeah.
So
Scott runs the Classic, the comedy club in New Zealand.
And that's the comedy club.
It was the comedy club, and it's been the home of New Zealand comedy for the better part of, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. It's pretty classic, as is the name. But now there's a couple more comedy clubs that have popped up. There's one just opened by another comedian called Vaughan King in Wellington. And so there's a comedy club there. And then there's all sorts of once a month kind of pubs pop on a comedy night. And they're very well organised and supported by New Zealand comedians. So, yeah.
How often then could you gig at that time when you first started?
When I was working, I was a full-time comedian when I moved to Auckland. So I would always gig in the weekends, and then there would be private functions and corporate work that I'd be able to get. And a lot of that work did come through the comedy club. So Scott would still be booking his acts out there, and he would get an offer because he was the people that people would call asking, we want to have our own comedy show. And he'd go, well, here's 4 comedians, and off they go.
Right.
And I think also because I was doing something different, being the tennis racket and nails guy, then I would go out and go into that. And also with the street performing background meant that I had all of my own gear, of my own amps, my own mic, so Scott could always know that I could turn up to any space and do a show, like no matter what. I would always be able to put on a show for however many people in whatever environment.
Right. And so full-time, can you define what full-time meant then? Just because it means different things in different areas depending on how much you have to earn.
Version of full-time is also different, because I had a once-a-week show at the casino, Sky City Casino. So on Tuesday nights, I did something called the NCB Comedy Hour, and I was the host of that for 6 years. It was also known as the Soul Destroyer, because it was one of the worst gigs on the planet. It was in the casino, so you'd have this stage, cabaret seating, and then nothing but pokey machines noisily going on in the background. And it was like an indoor street show for gambling addicts. So I would go out there, bring in a crowd, sit them down, and then put acts in front of them, and we'd all go home at the end of the night. But from that gig, with it being a casino, I charged them a lot of money to do it, and I could have lived off that for the week, but I decided I needed to do other performing to keep my brain sane. So that's when I would go down to the comedy club and do spots, and you'd pick up some extra money here and there, and yeah, like I said, corporates and private functions. Mm.
So you won an award, yes. And you thought, fuck the system.
Yeah.
I hate this award. I'm going to go the complete opposite way. And put, what was the thought about, like, tape?
The tape came about because of a Tim Burton book called The Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy. It's a series of poems and a short story. And there was a story in that called The Boy with Nails in His Eyes. And it's essentially a little poem about the boy with nails on his eyes. He puts up a Christmas tree and he couldn't see it, but it was beautiful. And I loved the idea of a name that spells out the entire thing. So that's where the boy with tape on his face. It was just the obvious kind of name. And, yeah, then it was just the tape was almost like a joking suggestion as well, backstage in the green room, of going, like, I ruined the show by talking to an audience. Well, I need to force myself to shut up, so the tape stops me talking.
How old were you when you started doing that iteration of the boy?
2005, so that would... I'm useless with my age because I tend to forget it.
About a decade ago, what are you
doing? I was born 78, so I am 37 this year. So
27.
Yeah, 27, look at that.
So... because this is like an odd question, but the boy, like when you say boy, you imagine someone quite young.
Yes. I'm hanging on to that for dear life.
do you think they'll get to a point where you'll have to change to the man, or you won't be able to do the act anymore?
Because I think, this comes back to evolving. You have to evolve or you die. And that's for me, I am evolving the show. So I'm soon going to, I think, get rid of the boy with tape on his face completely and evolve to just tape face. Because that's what people call me anyway, which is really strange, because the boy with tape on his face is a great title, but everyone, when we catch up and I want to ask them about some ideas or discuss shows and work, they go, oh, I'm catching up with Tape Face for coffee. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to go see Tape Face. Have you seen Tape Face? It's like, it's the name that kind of instantly sort of sits.
Yeah.
And also because I'm trying to open up the show to a worldwide demographic, I wanted something which is very easy and internationally understood and recognisable. And at the same time, a wee bit confusing to go, what is Tape Face?
I don't understand this
Tape Face.
Yeah, you can imagine headlines like...
Yeah, Tape Face comes to town.
Yeah.
Plague of Tape Face attacks.
Does anyone ever turn up with tape on their face? Like
One guy do it on a tour show, and it was the creepiest thing on the planet. My support act went out... bless him, Phil Buckley, and he did 15 or 20 minutes with this other guy in the front row with costume on and tape on his face, and he pointed him out and said he looked like an idiot, and it was creepy. And eventually, before I started the show, it was a bit weird, and I had to get the ushers to ask him to take the tape off, because it was just strange staring at this guy looking exactly like me. It was very odd. Didn't like that.
No. I assume you didn't use him as a...
No, he had enough attention on him.
Well, okay, that's it. Because the first time we ever spoke, we were at a BBC thing, and I remember talking to you about your comedy uniform.
Yes.
If you remember that.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Always have a comedy uniform.
Because I remember you liked that turn of phrase.
Yeah. And it's great, because it means I don't have to think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing. Because, like, and since then, I've read a book called Moonwalking with Einstein, and it's all about memory. And it's about how you remember stuff.
Yeah.
And you remember stuff. Basically, your memory makes pockets of new memories based around unique stuff.
Okay.
So, like, lunch would always be batched into different lunches, but then, like, the one day you go to, like, a really fancy restaurant for lunch,
that's a good lunch.
It stands out. Yeah, exactly. That's your agent's
important lunch. Important lunch. Yeah,
exactly. But so obviously having something unique but consistent makes you easy to remember.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, is it quite nice when you get to take it off and you're sort of like, I'm not at work anymore?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, when you lose the stripes and the tape. At the same time, I can't wear stripes. Like, now I can, when stripy tops are in fashion in all shops and bits and pieces, I hate them with a passion. Whenever I put any form of stripe on, it's like, this is the show's top. I can't, even different variations, it's like, no, stripes can't be worn. And even my wife, she doesn't wear stripy tops that much, because it's like, oh, you're wearing a tape face top. Oh, that's what we call it, it's a tape face top.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does ruin it to a degree, so, yeah.
Does it also feel quite nice that you can, like, walk around? I mean, how often do you get noticed when you're not?
I'm pretty lucky in that sense, where most people recognise the character more than me, and most people don't recognise me without tape on my face, which is quite good. And then also, chucking a piercing. I used to wear glasses as well. That was great. But then I ended up having to get laser surgery just so I could see my audience. Because picking volunteers was getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
So it was always nice to be able to pop on a lip ring, pop on the glasses. And it was the opposite of Superman to a degree. So I'd go from my little superhero on stage to just a normal person walking around. It's great fun. Yeah.
In my head, I'm like, that's a tax writer.
Like, well, you know, bloody damn right it was.
It's a business, bloody expense, isn't
it? I had to see people, otherwise the show fails.
But, so, I mean, because I know I've got friends who want to be famous. Like, that's like, they would like that to be their end goal.
That's not a goal.
No, I know it's not a goal. I mean, it's a byproduct of doing something good anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where a lot of people, they do want to be famous. They do want the TV show.
Yeah.
And it feels like, I like talking to people.
Those people need to be rounded up and put into a small room with one camera with no film in it and let them fight it out.
Yeah. Big brother.
Yeah, absolutely. But never open the door.
That's like Big Brother mixed with Saw.
Absolutely. That's a good, that's one show I would actually watch on television.
Yeah, exactly. But then they'd get what they want.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately.
I mean, it's quite nice because I like talking to people who are characters. I like talking to people who have something they consistently wear on stage.
Yeah.
Because for me, I mean, I'm trying to find something I consistently wear so that hopefully I don't get noticed. Not that I do anyway now, because I'm not big enough for that, but I want to have my own life when I'm not performing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I imagine, like, especially you've got a wife, girl?
Yeah, wife. I think it's different with stand-up, though, because you are putting more of yourself on stage. That's the thing. You're putting more of your own opinions and your own observations or your own interactions with other people. So you are more you on stage. Mm. So that means you can't really get away from yourself. Or otherwise your audience are then going to say you're not being real on stage, and then you're known as a guy who's being a character. Then you become a character. You're making the mental choice to go, your opinions on stage are not really what you think, which is tricky.
Yeah.
But then I also know that there's another comic who tells wonderful, fantastical stories, and that he sells out shows and DVDs, and he was once asked how much of it is true, and he didn't answer the question because he didn't want the audience to, think that he was making it up.
Right. So basically, he answered it by not answering it.
Pretty much, yeah. Right. That's the way liar.
So, I assume, at what point in the four iterations of Take Face did you start to, really get people to get it, if that makes sense?
I think when I first did the Edinburgh season, I'd always done the show in New Zealand and in Australia, and, I toured it, we were there, and it was a successful show, and I was very strategic. If anything, that's been my little, I would call my secret talent, is I'm very good at strategies and planning and goals. Right. You have to have goals for what you're doing, otherwise you don't achieve anything. Mm. And I have lots of goals, and I tend to tick them all off. And so my goal to come to Edinburgh, I essentially laid out a 5-year plan before going to Edinburgh. So the moment I debuted the show in New Zealand in 2005, I was thinking about Edinburgh for 2010. And that all came about because Flight of the Conchords won, they got nominated for the Perrier. Mm. And that was huge news in New Zealand. That was massive. That's the biggest comedy award in the world. You know, that's huge. And they were stars. So for me, that was I want to win that award. That's all I want to do. So I was like, how can I win that award? I need to go to Edinburgh to win that award. So how can I do that? So it's just working backwards. So develop the show, tour it through Australia, get it seen by some producers and promoters. So when it came time for me to come to Edinburgh, I was then able to really pick and choose where I wanted to be at what time, because people wanted me to have the show. And also enough other performers knew about me and knew the show and were always saying, when are you going to Edinburgh with it? When are you taking it to Edinburgh? So when I finally brought it to Edinburgh, they all went out and told everyone, you need to go see this show.
Yeah.
So that the buzz was already there before we started, which was nice.
That's a good way of
being.
Well, no, because I'm just thinking, for me, Edinburgh's a big decision, but for it's such a longer trip.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's a bit of a... But I'd moved over here at that point because I'd also, in 2007, I gave up comedy completely because I completely lost faith in it. I didn't understand why I was doing it anymore. So I'd done The Boy with Tape in His Face for a couple of years very successfully in New Zealand and Australia, and I was still doing my other comedy show as well. But I didn't have any enjoyment in it at all. I didn't know why. It just wasn't fun. So I'd lost all of the spark of it. So for me to sort of find... It was my little trek to Mecca was to go back to my roots and go, right, I'm going to become a street performer again. Because that's how I started out, with street performing. It's so that's what started me becoming a comedian. So then go back to it and rediscover. And so I gave up all indoor performing, moved away from Auckland, back to my hometown Christchurch, and just started busking there with my now wife. She was girlfriend at the time, and she was a street performer as well. And so where the two of us just busked and hung out, and it was wonderful. And then moved over to London to just work in Covent Garden, and just worked Covent Garden every day for, I think, 1.5-2 years. And then slowly more people started hearing that I had this other show, and would I do a spot, and would they see it, and can they see it. And then eventually my agents saw me, and they wanted to sign me, and I've stayed with them ever since, Gag Reflex, who have been great. Yeah, and so it was accidentally then I found myself back in a comedy career, but this time I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was kind of nice.
Yeah, because I chatted to Stuart Goldsmith a while ago, who's a street performer, but never mentions it. And
strange, he never mentions that.
You have to mention that every time as well now. It's become like ongoing. But yeah, he was telling me like he just loves street performing, and I'm getting him on soon because I have no idea why he does comedy then if he loves it that much. And it's kind of interesting, but I mean, it's such a different... Do you ever just then just rock... Like you said, you're currently... I mean, this will go out after Edinburgh, so no one will know where you are during the Fringe.
Yeah.
But you're like overlooking
the mile.
Spots.
Yeah, I love that spot because I love watching the street performing because I love the science of busking. For me, it's such the politest robbery watching. If it's done well, it's really, really good because you're watching, you know, one person or two people manipulate an entire audience to stop and open up their wallets and give you money. And the reason, and again, this maybe is for Stuart, I don't know, but for me, what I loved about street performing was the fact... Oh, actually, no, that's not what I love about street performing. It's one of the byproducts of street performing is that you can do the biggest show on the mile, you can do the biggest show anywhere in Edinburgh and have a huge audience watching you and be super, at the time, famous at one moment.
I've got problems with bees.
I know, there's a bee hoovering around, it's great.
Yeah, I'll edit that bit out, but I just can't deal with things flying at me, do you know what I mean?
It's hilarious, it's great.
No, they're just scary, they're just fucking... Anyway, sorry, we're off topic.
So the thing about street shows is that you can get this huge crowd of, you know, up to 1,000 people watching you. They all pay you at the end of the show. They're all clapping and cheering, going, you're a hero, you're a star, you're amazing. And then within 5 minutes, you're completely alone, packing up your gear, and nobody gives a shit who you are. And so I think that's the difference, is the people who do comedy will start off doing, you know, the open mic circuit, work their ass off in a room for 15 people in the hope that one day they'll be doing the, you know, the bigger rooms, and their name, and they've got posters, they've got flyers and all that sort of thing. And they're famous, and that's what they want. They want recognition as well as the product. Whereas street performers don't care about the recognition; they just want the product, which is it's more of a pirate approach, I think.
Yeah, because for me, street performing is really interesting because, like, how? Okay, so with comedy, I started out. I did 5 minute spots, then I did 7 minute spots, 10 minute spots, 15, 20. Yep. Carry it on, and now I'm doing an hour up here, right? With street performing, I imagine you can't just go out and do, I'm just going to do 5 minutes.
No,
I'm
not really.
I'm going
to
do like a five spot on this corner.
You
like,
tend to work on...
You have
on,
to just know.
You work on your skills. You find someone who will kind of mentor you to do a show, and you work up a small little show, and you can work... In Edinburgh, you can work the Alcoves by St Giles, or in London, you can work on the South Bank, just banging out little 20-minute shows. You want to get enough... You get enough material to do 20 minutes, so you can build a crowd, do a couple of tricks, ask for money, and get it to go away. And then you just slowly build it up from there. And it is just like the comedy thing. You do a 30-minute show, then you do a 45-minute show. And then that's all you need. There are some street performers out there who have not changed their show in 20 years. Like, they are still doing word for word the same show in Covent Garden that they were doing 20 years ago because it works and nobody cares because they're just that person who juggles on a rope on a ladder with a unicycle. That's what they do.
There are comedians like that.
Absolutely.
If you have a working...
But everybody knows who they are.
Oh yeah.
That's the difference.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I was chatting to nameless comics. Let's leave it as that. But they've been doing this same 20 for ages, and it's because they're like, well, because the promoters know what I'm going to do. I'm not going to fuck it up. That it but works 90% of the time.
That's a totally valid goal. Like, I have friends who just want to be very good club comics. And like that's there's a place in the market for being a good, strong club comic. You don't have to do a 1 hour show of, oh, my dad's dead, my cat's here, my one or whatnot. It's just not a reason for doing an Edinburgh show. And so many people think that that's a reason to do a show. I've got to get my hour ready. It's like, why? What are you going to do afterwards? What are you going to do afterwards with your hour? If you have the profile to go touring, that's great. But otherwise, why are you writing this hour? Write material, all great, but, you know, bank it away for a rainy day.
Definitely.
And then when you're in a position to do your hour, go for it. Yeah,
it's totally, like you said, it's forward planning.
Yeah.
And a lot of people I've met who are early on sort of go, yeah, I'm just going to go and do a freehander, or yeah, I'm going to then work up for my hour. And you're like, but why do you want
to
do that hour?
Yeah,
what is the point of the show? And it's really nice to, like, because so far, I mean, I had Joe Lycett on a while ago, and he didn't really comment on this. And it's nice to know that you had this kind of plan.
Oh yeah, you've got to, for me, you have to have a plan.
Yeah.
It's always got to be going forwards or going somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
there has to be an end game, and doing a show, it's like the famous thing, being famous is not an end game, and doing a show is not an end game. You know, that should not be a goal, as to I want to do a show. It's like, well, you have to know why you're doing a show and what is the show going to give back to you at the end of it.
So Your aim was to win the Perrier Award.
Well, at the time, that was the initial goal, was to, I wanted to win the Perrier. And that, so that was a nice kind of benchmark. If anything, they become like little markers that you go, I want to win the Perrier, boom, okay, I want to do this, I want to do that. Like, I've never won the Perrier, and I don't think I ever will, which is as frustrating as all hell. And that's, the thing is that the goalposts are allowed to move, but and the goal was there, which meant that I got to do the shows, which got me to the position to then be allowed to change the goal. Like, yeah, and the other thing is that just because you put the goal down and go, okay, I didn't achieve the goal, but I've done all this other stuff that got me here, they are achievements. Like, I can't completely undermine myself and go, oh, I didn't get the main prize. Oh, well, doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's the whole shoot for the stars, yeah. And if you don't, that wanky...
Yeah, whatever it is, yeah, the journey, blah, 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 yeah, blah, yeah. Yeah.
But it's true.
You're like, a winner and a loser at the same time. not quite as catchy.
Yeah. But you've lost at the thing you want, didn't you?
Yeah, but I achieved... and in some cases, it was only in losing the prize that it made me realise that I'm far happier being the loser than actually winning it. Because in some cases, had I, in the year... Like, it's almost... Yeah, I wasn't able to be eligible for the prize because my venue was too big. And it's right. Like, oh, okay, so I'm selling too many tickets. That's a problem. That's my problem. Okay, there are worse problems out there in Edinburgh, is having too many people seeing your show.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
I've got worse problems than that. That's amazing. So, okay, so you came up here. You had a great show. Gag Reflex noticed you. Did you contact them? Did they just come down?
I was seen by one of their former clients in Australia. And essentially the client contacted his agent saying, you need to see this guy, you need to see this guy. And then when I came back over, I was busking. And then the comic contacted me and said, would I do a tour support spot for him so his agent could see me? And then I did this one show, and Lee at Gag said, yeah, he liked it. We had a meeting. And like, I'd been talking to some other agents at the time and just sort of feeling out who I had a good vibe with. Mm. And what I liked about Gag Reflex was that they were the most true to the show that I liked. Like, we've talked lots, and he's got the show's interest at heart rather than making money.
Right.
Which is quite nice, you know. We talk about where do we want to take the show, what's right for the show, what's right for the character, you know. And some, you know, even some TV spots that I've been offered, we'll have big discussions about should I do this or not, because it's beneficial to get the profile and go on TV, but at the same time it's like, well, now I'm associated with this character and this person and whatnot, so it's like, well, let's turn that one down. I don't want to do that because that's not good for me. Yeah,
yeah, totally.
So it's good to have an agent who's also got the long game approach in mind. Like, there's some agencies out there who would just go now, where's our commission, go now, where's our commission. It's like, I don't want that. Yeah,
right. And out of interest, I mean, like, the other agents, you don't need to mention who they were, but the other agents, what made you feel like they wouldn't necessarily have
it? Was
the...
more of a business kind of approach to it that I didn't really go for me. I've got and maybe this is my kind of street performer mindset, I treat everything very much like a mafia, which is a nice-ish mafia, but don't fuck with me or I'll really hurt you. That's a fairly nice way of putting it.
On the
yeah,
we'll make sure you have it all covered.
So yeah. It's that thing of going, I'm also with the my approach, and this has also been my approach to life, is that if I have my word to something, then I will stand by it and do it until I die to a degree. So it's like, I treat my agents like a family, you know, and even all of the other clients in the agency they're all family. Our goal is to all help each other,
yeah.
and all equally share whatever, which is the way to do it. And with Gag, it was like Lee had the... Yeah, and Dave came down as well for this meeting, and we just sat around and essentially we just got drunk, and it was great, and it was more kind of chatty and nice and normal, and you could just tell straight away that they were good, honest, good people. They were the good guys. Mm. And it was the other, and whereas the other ones, you had that vibe of they just wanted to make the money, and they saw potential in the character and the product, and they were very much looking at it as a product. And I'm happy to be looked at as a product, but I have to be looked at as a human being first. Yeah
definitely, because that's really, because I mean, As someone who plays a character,
yeah,
you might be able to detach yourself from it and think that is a product.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Is it just because you've done it for so long now, it's part of you that it still seems like a person, or is it...
There is a person of the boy with tape on his face who I can switch into and think that way to a degree. But when I become me, I'm very, you know, I'm a incredibly serious, boring person as well. I'm not all full of whimsy and light things. It's like some of my... my favourite, you know, style of comedy is incredibly dark and horrible comedy. Like, most people expect me to like, oh, unicorns and rainbows and ponies, la 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 la. No, no, I like the most darkest, horrible thoughts are really, really funny.
Who are yours?
I'm a big fan of like Frankie Boyle and Jimmy Carr and that sort of thing. And I like good quality offensive comedy. You know, offensive yes. comedy that is thought through, I really enjoy. And someone who can really back up their opinions is nice.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's fun.
I definitely know what you mean, because there's a lot of comedians who just go, oh, well, that has a setup and a punch, and therefore it's funny.
Yeah.
So it's worth saying. And you're like, well, no, that's just going to be offensive to a group. And
yeah,
like,
that's it.
Yeah, but that's what I am.
I want to see the comedian get the heckle from the audience going, that is inappropriate, that is wrong, and then argue the point to turn the heckle
yes.
around. It's like, that's wonderful. That's great fun. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah
Changing
yeah.
people.
Sometimes I want to do that, but the thing is, as a fellow performer, I do get paranoid. They'll come to mine and go, well, you came to
this.
Mine.
Yeah. yeah. Now you're saying this.
Yeah. And you're like, well, hypocrite. Yeah, I can back it up, but like, it's just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, it's awkward, and you sort of feel like this level of colleague workmateness that you
yeah.
sort of say
yeah.
even if you're a bit like that, you wait till after.
Yeah, and have a quiet word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. I mean, like, have you ever heckled a person that you thought was particularly
No, there was one act in New Zealand I heckled, which was just, it was two guys who were, they were just trying to be famous, and it turned out they were filming a mockumentary that went on TV about trying to become famous, and they went on stage and they just wasted the audience time, and I ended up yelling something, I can't remember what, but I just got so frustrated with them wasting, like, I don't want to see anybody wasting audience's time.
No.
And, the people have paid money to come and see a show, give them a show, don't improvise, but that was offensive to all improvisers here. Everywhere, it's that thing of don't go out there with nothing planned or no thoughts in your head of comedy or no intention of giving the audience what they want.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Last year I saw an improvisation show, and I remember leaving thinking they didn't know that improvisation doesn't mean just do
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, it was like, you definitely, I mean, it yeah. felt like they had some stuff planned, but it yeah. definitely didn't feel like an hour
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah, you have to
was...
give the audience their ticket price worth of entertainment.
It was a free
yeah.
show. I was
oh, well,
fine.
That's exactly why it was like...
that I felt like I couldn't complain.
Yeah.
So at this point in time in this narrative, mm. you've done your 2010 show, you've got yourself some management, they've sort of they've sort of seen
profiles
you as a human,
bumping up a wee bit, yep.
Yeah. And where did you want to go from there, and where did management want to take you from there?
We sort of just talked about just doing more shows. It was always about, then goalposts shifted to what I dreamed of doing as a kid, which was Royal Variety, which was really nice. So that became I have a little book of ideas of what I want to do and things and performances I want to try out. So he would just chip away at these little goals of getting contacts and getting me onto these shows. And then it was always about touring and just building my audience. So it was just getting out and doing the show. Like, I'd been doing the show in New Zealand for a few years, but in the UK there's just so many more opportunities to perform. And like, to be going around art centres and constantly working the UK was great. So I did a national tour, then we did a slightly bigger national tour, and then it was just a case of writing more material and coming up with a second show.
Mm. Mm. Okay, and it's kind of an odd question, and don't take it the wrong way, but... Okay, so when I have an idea for a joke, I write it down. I tend to leave it for probably a week and then go back to it. And then if I still think that's a funny idea, I'll try and write something, and then I'll go to an open mic night or whatever and try it.
Yeah.
I can't imagine you doing that as a thing.
Imagine a room full of boxes. And inside those boxes are things that look funny.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what I've got. I've got a little studio room that is full of plastic boxes of props that I've bought from junk shops and places and all sorts of oddities, and also hardware stores. It's like, I find things that are just, yeah, normal looking, and I think this is going to get intense. Walking tour?
Do you want to do a show?
No. So I find props in like these shops. Then my favourite shop was now closed, which was the best one, called Red Rocket, and they sold everything, which was incredible. And so I'd go in there and pace the aisles, buying like 7 plungers and toilet seats and bits and pieces, and then I just shove them in a box, and then I go, I think that's funny. There's some rubber gloves and a toilet plunger, or a toilet brush and some, yeah, what have I got at the moment? I created the Funbrella, which is those droning a droning toy that goes meow, meow. So I attach that to an umbrella. When you spin it, it just creates this wonderful noise. So
right. That's
the Funbrella. I don't know what it does, but it's funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just these things that I think are good. And then I've also got my iTunes library and Spotify playlists, where I just collect music of just going, there's something funny in that. whenever I hear 500 Miles by the Proclaimers, there's something else there. That I know it. One day I will do a joke with 500 Miles, and it's like, I have to do that.
You heard it here first.
It's going to happen,
That's an exclusive. Well, now, I mean, I remember you saying something similar on a different interview where you said your wife just basically locks you in a room.
Oh, yeah, that was the second show.
And, like, basically you're not allowed out until you have something.
Yeah.
And how, I mean, for me, so, like, in the run-up to this show, I remember, so it's that whole creative process thing where, like, you leave it all to pretty much the last minute. It doesn't feel like you can do that.
No, I did.
Oh, okay, right.
Essentially, with the second show, More Tape, I booked that into the Adelaide Fringe Festival before I had the show. So we were committed to going there, and I was on tour with the first show. I remember having a really intense discussion with my wife saying about how I don't think we can go to Australia because I don't have a show. And then it was like, well, that was the locking me in the room in October kind of thing. And it's like, you have to come up with something. Good luck. Mm. And then it's just a whole bunch of ideas very quickly thrown together. And it worked, which was nice. It was a panicked evolution.
Yeah.
And I had just the right tools and the right music at the time to make it something work. And then I was lucky to have Australia and New Zealand to try it out. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. I tend to do all of my work in progress on the other side of the world because I kind of feel like over here I've got such a broader audience of people who have seen the show. I don't want to give them the this sounds horrible for New Zealand and Australian people. I don't want to give them the sub the byproduct of just me mucking around. I want to give them the good show and muck around over there. But then I tend to go back to New Zealand and Australia a few years later and go, this is how what you should have seen. This is how it was supposed to look.
Only like 3 or 4% of my audience is there. You'll be fine.
That's all right. That's all good.
They might pass it round.
Yeah, fuck them.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So you booked a load of shows, or you booked a Fringe festival.
Yeah, book a Fringe in Australia and some shows in New Zealand.
Yeah. And you've been locked in a room.
Yeah.
So say at the end of the day, your wife's sort of gone, are you ready for dinner? Like, can you come out? And she lets you out. Do you just go, cool, you sit there, I'm going to put some tape on, I'm going to show you what I've done?
Or is it not so much the tape on? I tend to go, here's an idea, what do you think of this? And I go, here's a puppet, look at this, or here's, I'm thinking of doing this. And then it was very much a case.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So if she would laugh, then it was funny. Then I would know I'm onto something. If I had to explain it to her, I'm not doing the right thing. It's like there was a set, I worked for ages on a set of legs that I wanted a volunteer to wear, and the legs would hang in front of them, and I would control the feet with the massive arms in the back, and I wanted them to dance to Riverdance. And that was the whole, I was fascinated with the idea of somebody standing there awkwardly while I controlled their legs. And that evolved from there, me going over and over, I want to do this, I want to do this, and then she was just going, I need to let it go, it's not funny, let it go. And then eventually I scaled, and it was like, well, what is funny? What do I want to see? I want to see legs moving. So I scaled it down and I made a tiny puppet that had legs that I controlled, which worked.
Right.
And then she just went, yes, that's right, do that. So
that's
okay,
interesting. Because for me, what you do, and this is not meant offensively, when what you do, if I explain it to someone, they laugh at the absurdity of the explanation. So like, I remember one of the first things that I saw of yours that I fell in love with was you dancing with yourself with like a cape.
Oh, yeah, the redress. See, that's a very bog standard old mime classic.
And
if anything, I kind of feel like the only part of that routine that I've put my own take on is the repetition of graving the ass and then maybe pulling the bra out. But that's my own little take on it. Like, there's so many routines. I think Charlie Chaplin even did the coat arm thing as well. So
Okay. Well, apparently I don't have the mime knowledge,
the mime, but... mime background, the mime history.
So well, this is why you're doing so well in this circuit, is because none of us knows. You're just doing what Charlie Chaplin did. But like, so when I explained that to someone, I remember getting halfway through the explanation, I just went, oh fuck it, I'll get it up on YouTube. This, yeah. I'll just get it up, you know what I mean? Yeah. And they watched it and they loved it, and it was like, this is really fun and like weird and like interesting to watch. Yeah. And it's funny, but it's not like,
can't describe it. You
joke
have to watch
funny,
it.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I think then also that's good for me, because then it's easier then, and also as an advertising tool, people, you say to people, you have to see it. You have to see it. You know, and we also say, the less you know, the more you will enjoy it. That's the other thing. So if you go into it knowing nothing about the show, then you have a completely pure experience, which is quite nice.
Well, that, I mean, because we were talking about social media before we got on here, and a lot of comedians are against people torrenting and then like sharing their
content,
clips and stuff. But I imagine that has helped you.
To a degree. Well, the YouTube side of it hasn't so much. Like, I try and keep as much off YouTube as possible, because otherwise people know the joke. Like, I do a routine with the oven gloves, so I put oven gloves on my hand and then sort of move them around and sing Endless Love. And so the moment that sort of started going around YouTube quite a lot and getting on some TV shows, whenever I pulled the gloves out, I could feel the audience go, oh, it's this bit. And then it's a long minute 30 of me doing, oh, this bit. So everyone's staring at me. We all know the joke and we all have to move on. So it's tricky in that sense for me. But whereas the social media side, I think you have to... I prefer engaging with my audience.
So, okay, that's it. So have you thought about... I mean, so you would prefer it if people didn't share...
I think
clips of you,
not sharing the content exactly, but sharing the world of Tape Face is quite good. Sharing the idea of telling your friends, going, I want to go see this guy, go see this guy, but rather than going, here, watch this, and then go see this guy, and then they go, yep, he did exactly what you showed me. Because that's the other thing about my routine, is that I'm lucky enough that I don't have to change it that much.
Yeah, I can see why that is useful, but also what you do feels sometimes like a classic album.
Yeah.
So like you could watch it online and then watch it in real life.
Watch in real life. Yeah.
And it's better in real life, like on an album where you like seeing the artist live.
Yeah.
But you don't. It's not like a, so like there are some comedians I'll go and see once, I'll enjoy it, but I don't want to see them like 100 times.
Yeah.
Whereas with you feel like you could come back and see this guy clowning, and because he brings people up and it's always
different. Yeah, you're watching that. Yeah. And you're watching your friend's reaction to it as well, which is quite fun. Yeah. No, there is that element to it, which is, it's great for me, because that does mean I have managed to get more longevity out of the shows than most comics. Like the show that I have recently been touring back into Canada was, you know, it's their first show. So that's 10 years old and it's still funny and still people laugh at all the right points. And I imagine I can still probably get away with doing that in different countries for the next 10 years. Yeah. So it's quite fun. I just need to go where there's different audiences and more people. It's quite nice.
And you were saying before, like, how you're using joke structures that are the same as comedians.
Yeah.
Now, this is only because I don't know how you're doing it. But for me, I don't know what you mean by that. Because for me, like a one-liner joke is da-da-da, da-da-da. Or like a longer joke is like da-da-da, absurdity, da-da-da-da, or whatever.
For me, it was more about like the first show. If you put the two side by side, the first show is more one-liner based comedy, because it's like I get a volunteer up, I do one joke, and then they go away. Next volunteer up, we do, and there's short little vignettes. Most of the jokes are at most 2 minutes long. Whereas the second show, but then the first show also has the same comedy structure of running gags and structure of a finale that is planted at the start of the show that you want to do. So everything's neatly tied up at the end of the show, and there's, you've got your reoccurring characters or reoccurring themes throughout. And I kept that in the second show of a red button and volunteers and that sort of thing. But the second show started becoming more longer form joke telling, where I would get a volunteer up to do one routine and the joke would happen, and then they would stay there to get more volunteers on stage to add to it. So that then for me it became more of a story based show. Yeah, so that's what it was for me.
Right. And do you feel the audience has moved with you, or do you think you've changed, like you've lost and gained some different people as you've moved?
I think there's always you always lose and gain people, which is the I think you have to. No, that's always just comes back to evolving as a performer. And I'm sure that when I bring out Tape Face 9, there will be a whole completely different audience again. Like, that's the thing, you have to. Otherwise, you're just going to end up being the person who does that same style show over and over and over, preaching to the choir of your hard hardcore fans. And it's like, I would rather try and tap a new audience every single year and go, I'm introducing a new character to, and also bringing the people who want to see the evolution. Like, I'm sure there are people who are going to say, I preferred it when you did it this way. And it's like, that's good. Why don't you go do it? That's why I'm doing it, because it's fun for me. I want to see what Tapeface will do in this sort of form of evolution. You know, it's like, how many Batmans are there? Yeah, there's so many different variations of Spider-Man. It's like, you want to see a different version. You want to see the different jokes done in their hands. And also for me, writing in a different headspace, like the show that I've written for the one-off show in Edinburgh, it's so surreal and so strange that I can't imagine my old Tapeface character doing it at all, because it's just too weird. It's too odd.
Okay. Mm. And does that reflect in the marketing then? Like, when you... because. Go on, sorry.
Yeah, no, it does. Absolutely, it wouldn't do in the marketing, because the first version of the boy with tape on his face is such a kind of clean boy next door doing this surreal, silly, playful clown show. And then the marketing, as we're getting, it's almost like the boy's growing up. That's kind of the easiest way to think of it. So becoming Tapeface meant that, you know, he's becoming a wee bit more teenagery, a wee bit more confident with just being who he is. Like, I'm enjoying audiences looking at the character and me finding funny moments out of audience members with nothing else, which is really, really fun. And then it becomes more of a genuine experience of a show. That's the other thing, is to create a show that is a complete audience interactive immersive experience. From the moment you get your ticket and you're standing in the queue, this should be something happening, or the audience needs to start shifting gear into the mindset of Tapeface at that point.
And you were talking about like engaging with your audience and like chatting with them, and I remember talking to you again briefly before we got on. We talked a lot briefly before we got on. It was great. We got the secret of comedy. It was amazing.
Incredible. $49.95, you can do it.
Go to tapefaceboy.com. So you were talking about, because I said that your Twitter feed only follows like 8 accounts.
Yes.
And you said that's because it's a business account.
Yeah, very much so.
And I mean, do you want to elaborate on...
I've got my own personal account where I do get to say anything I want, and those of you who do follow that will see some of the comments that are just ridiculous. And I genuinely talk with friends on that Twitter account of just banter and nonsense. Whereas the Tapeface account, like, that's gone through several evolutions. When I first ever went onto Twitter, I used to tweet in Morse code because I thought that was funny. But then you cannot say a lot with, you know, 140 characters in Morse code. So it went from... I then started tweeting as normal, and then people started criticizing my tweeting because they didn't want to hear my voice, which I found hilarious because it was like, you're hearing a voice inside your head that they were then pushing onto me. It's like they didn't like the idea of me being able to talk. So after much discussion and kind of open debate on social media, we came to a massive conclusion that I should tweet in the third person. And so for several years I tweeted as, the boy is doing this, the boy thinks that. But then it meant that I had to very much think about what I was tweeting. So, and also my character wouldn't, I don't, as a 9-year-old boy with tape on his face, or as my brain thinks in the show, I don't tweet about public opinions. I don't tweet about current events, because it's not, I don't want to bring that into my world.
The boy wouldn't almost have any opinions.
No,
on those
not
things.
At all. No, not on the side. It doesn't care for any wars, any problems, any people, any countries, any sex, any nothing. It doesn't. You know, boy's more interested in, I've got oven gloves. Yeah. Want to see this?
It's good to know the boy's anti-war.
To a degree, absolutely. To a degree, I suppose that's where it was a wee bit more whimsical and unicorns and whatnot, because it was very safe. Yeah. But then now it's become, because I'm also trying to step up the show and partially step away from it. Like, I very much want to put a block between me and the show. So the account now is tweeting Tapeface ... and then a little bit of a sentence, and sometimes just some random stuff for fun, and that's
and how has that worked for you, like, engage? I mean, so okay, when did you join Twitter?
No idea. 2008,
okay,
maybe?
So this was before your first Edinburgh show.
Yeah.
So were you using that to build a bit of an audience and a buzz before the show?
I just had it. I didn't really know what I was doing with it. Yeah, it was one of those things where I think we started realising after Edinburgh Run that Twitter was a viable advertising tool. And then in regards to social media, I tend to put Twitter at the top of the food pyramid. And like, my Facebook account, for people who follow that, it is a dumping ground. I can't stand Facebook at all. It's a horrible thing. But it's a good phone book. That's all it is for me. It's a phone book and a messaging service. But everything that goes onto my Facebook page is literally a push from Twitter. So if you follow me on Twitter, you get all the information first. And I tend to engage with people quicker on Twitter, whereas for Facebook, I've got to log in, go to the page, open up, see who's commented, and then go through the comment. I still go there and I still comment and I still engage with people because I don't want people to go, he never replies on this. It's like you have to still engage with people who are wanting to engage with you. But my first port of call is always going to be Twitter because that's the most instant. You tend to get the most, the quickest response and the instant reaction on it.
And what else have you tried then in terms of trying to build an audience and marketing?
Well, it's also interesting in different countries what's stronger. Like in Australia, Instagram is bigger than Twitter. So and I don't really have Instagram that much. So it meant that I had to up my Instagram So I had to get two accounts on that, one for a personal for my own sort of life and whatnot, and then one which was Tapeface, which then becomes about, well, what does Tapeface want to take photos of? This is a whole different thing. How does Tapeface see? So a lot of my Instagram pictures are, they tend to be just black and white and a lot of filters chucked over them kind of thing to grayscale them up. Anything that sort of pops out, Aloe came about for a while and came and went, but then when there was the risk of Twitter or Facebook, you know, closing down accounts with people with no names, and it was like, well, I'll get on Aloe and I'll boost the hell out of that to try and get a lot of followers very quickly, and then everyone just went back to Facebook.
I mean, I can imagine you doing really well on Vine.
I tend not to. Again, it's the, I'm never organized enough to create the content, because that's the other thing, is that if I do Vines, people want to see the costume and the character, and I'm not carrying the costume and character around with me all the time. We talked for ages, me and my agent, about I should always have a roll of tape in my bag so I can quickly take a photo, or if I need to. It's just like, I can't be asked doing that. So a lot of photos, I just put my hand in front of my mouth, and that's my token kind of, that's me being Tapeface when I'm out and about in public. Vine is a good one, but it's just creating content, you just have to be so onto it and have the time and the ideas for it. And for me, I'd just rather read a book.
That's fair. That's definitely, yeah. I mean, like I said to you, my day job's in social media, and like generally what I do is I'll plan a month's worth of content ahead of time and then schedule it out.
Yeah.
And then that way I do that for my own Twitter. Like I just schedule my I don't know what's going out today. Just because it's easier for me to like write 20 tweets, put them out, and then not sit there, but then check it at the end of every day and see if someone's replied.
Yeah.
And like some people, like new people, sometimes go, "I took you 9 hours to respond to my witty response," and I'm like, yeah, but
I didn't see it.
I'm not on it all day. Like I'm on it. Like if like someone I follow tweets me and it like gives me an alert, I'll reply and then I might check it. Yeah. But I can't spend my day on it.
No, I can't understand how people like Stephen Fry tweet so much all the time. It's like, God, you do so much already. How are you on this device all the time? And I'm pretty sure like Jimmy Carr's account, he's got a joke that pops up, just one-liners.
Yeah, all the time.
So that's like 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock every day. Funny that it's always those times.
Yeah.
And so I briefly put my toe in the water of that, where I got a mate in New Zealand to write some tweets for me, and so we did the same sort of thing. I just said, write me some whimsical tweets, and he wrote me 2,000 tweets, and I loaded those in and put them out there, and it was fine having the content. And I think again it's that thing of whenever people would engage with those tweets, then I would come into the conversation and respond as me and play along with it. But I ended up stopping doing that just because I kind of felt like it wasn't worth it for me just to do it. I'd rather say something when I had something to say, or if I'm genuinely feeling like a boy with tape in his face tweet, I can tweet it and a thing then.
Yeah, because I had a thing 2 days ago actually, because I was out and about and I had this idea for a tweet. I tweeted it, and then about a minute later another one went out on the scheduler, and it looked weird because I tweeted something about from the Chinese restaurant by the station,
and then suddenly
then the next one was a McDonald's one, and the people thought, what the fuck is he doing eating two meals in like 5 minutes? I'm like, hungry guys, I'm hungry,
gotta work it. Yeah. Anyway, I'm working hard.
I've got to eat loads of takeaways, obviously. That's where your bucket money's going. But that's good. So and did you just encourage people to follow you, or did they look you up? I mean, how did that evolve for you?
I started putting my Twitter handle on my cardboard boxes in my show. So I've had two cardboard boxes on stage all the time, and again I was touring with my support act, and we got talking about social media a lot and the use of it, and then it was just a case of going, well, I've got these little tiny billboards on stage for the entire show, so let's put a sign on them. And I would pick up followers, people are sitting in an audience for 15 minutes looking at a box, they tend to follow it and tweet or take a photo of me and tag me in it, which is fine. But I didn't really encourage people to, maybe on Facebook I occasionally push it, going, follow me here to get this information, but not so much really.
Yeah, it's because, I mean, the hardest part for me is I've found that if you don't ask them or you don't tell them you're there, a lot of people just like leave and go, oh, he was great, and then forget your name and forget who you are.
Yeah.
And to build that relationship, you need to have a constant conversation going on.
Yeah.
So, how should we say, have any conversation on stage.
Yeah.
So it just seemed interesting how you would get around that.
Yeah, there needs to be another way to do it. Like every show I've seen in Edinburgh this year, there has been a point where the performer has mentioned, I've got a Twitter account, or go to this hashtag.
Mm.
So it's just become, that's the way of communicating. And also, the Twitter side of things is stronger than some reviews. Like, you know, a lot of people are just, you know, posting tweets, and that's getting spread around, and that is the new currency of word of mouth.
Mm.
Like, I can't think of a show I last went up to somebody and went, you need to go see the show, it's amazing. Like, I do that to my small circle of friends, but to complete strangers, I'm not going to go up to them. Whereas if I pop out a tweet, somebody else retweets it, it hits a much broader audience, and then the more it sort of goes out there, then the more people will go see shows.
Yeah, definitely. And did you like use hashtags for each show then? To
I've started sure that- using hashtags. Like, I've started using one for the Christmas special, and I've got one that I've got consistent for the developing of my new show called just TF Plans. And so Tape Face Plans. And
right.
So anytime I'm working on something for the new show or something which is to do with Tape Face currently for next year's and the bigger show in general, then that's what I'm using Tape Face Plans.
Okay, cool. And like, in terms of like getting repeat audience back, let's talk about this really quickly. You said that you've got a one-off show in Edinburgh.
Yes.
Which, if you're listening to this, you will have missed.
You would have missed this one. But it was so weird. Oh, it was so good.
Well, yeah, and you said that, like, the content in it is weird.
Yes, absolutely. It's it came from a character exercise after working with a director on developing new material for a bigger show, and so a lot of the content I think it's too weird. And, you know, who knows? It might go into the show. I don't know. Currently, for me, it's too strange.
So it's just you that thinks it's strange?
Yeah, I definitely think it's too weird. Some of the routines, well, you've missed it, so I'm going to tell you some of them. Like, there's one, I've got a Harrison Ford plate spinning routine. So I know.
Again, try and explain your thing to anyone.
But then, you know, this, now I fall into the category of most audience members where I can't explain it. You have to see it. It makes no, it does, and the dumb thing is that I say it makes no logical sense, but when you're watching it, you go, well, that makes perfect sense. There's a routine where a Rubik's Cube turns into a pig and I get an audience member to try and solve the pig. It's just very surreal and silly. We're throwing party poppers at mimes, we're throwing strawberries at somebody trying to play swing ball tennis. It's it's a really messy, childish show. But it's very much like the do you remember when David Bowie went to Germany and took a lot of drugs, came back with Ziggy Stardust? That's it. This is my Ziggy Stardust. Yeah.
I like that optimism.
Yeah, that's what it is. Okay. And this is the show that people go, if they watch it, they will go, he's lost the plot. And a lot of people, if reviewers and other agents are going to come to it and go, is this what he's doing next year? Is this what he's doing? Why is he doing this? Well, what happened to the mime?
You said that you've told your agent some of the ideas, and they said,
don't show this to anyone.
That's really interesting, because like, agents tend to, like, I mean, from the agents I've spoken to, like for the pod and for different things, they say we try and always steer them to make sure that they're going to make the right choices, both for the show, but also so that you can sell it, and so our marketing works and stuff.
Yeah,
and because I suppose because it's a one-off.
Yeah, it's fine, and also because we're going into it, we are telling people that don't expect that this is the show. This is not, forget everything you know about the boy with Tavern Space and enjoy this experience. For if anything, this one-off show is more about the advertising side of things. I just want to let people know that the Boy with Tavern Space still exists, like we are, and that we are coming back, that we're not going anywhere completely. We do want to we want the audiences to come with us on this new journey of Tape Face. So it's just putting those people at ease of going, we haven't stopped just because we're going to other countries. Although I do say that as well to lots of performers. It's like, you don't have to go to Edinburgh. There are a lot of other countries and a lot of other festivals, and there's also a lot of August.
Yeah.
You know, claim back your August.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I will be doing that next year.
Yeah.
I'll be doing Camden and then probably nothing else. Probably go on holiday.
Yeah, that's the thing. Go on holiday. You know, enjoy it.
Yeah. But you go to New Zealand and Australia to like test out stuff essentially. Yeah. I mean, are those good audiences for that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, okay. I've got a very good following in both countries, and it's quite nice. And it's the festivals that I go to are very well organised and well attended and good fun. And they also, the Adelaide Fringe Festival tends to get a lot of people trying out material anyway for Melbourne Comedy Festival. And in New Zealand, the comedy industry there is very, very well supported.
But when you weren't established, were they still the best place to do tryout material, or?
Yeah, that was only because I didn't have any other place to go. There's no other option.
Stay at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, I just wanted, because there's three comedy festivals in Australia. And I believe there's only one in New Zealand. So it just, I just wondered if like you'd had any different experiences. Cause
well, the thing about the Melbourne Festival and the Adelaide Fringe Festival is that they're about a month long, each of them. So you really get a chance to run out your show. Right. Whereas in New Zealand, the festival, your show tends to run for 5 nights only. Mm. So like, and that's the other frustrating thing also with Edinburgh. And that's probably why so many performers want to rush here to do it, because they want to do their show every night for a month. Because at the end of that month, after doing your show, you are a better performer. There's no doubt about it. Or you have come to terms that you are not a better performer and you should stop. But you, there's in this country, in the UK, you don't really get the chance to go to a festival. Like some festivals pop up, you do one night here or two nights there. But to run your show for a month is so valuable. So to have that in Australia for 2 months and then New Zealand to kind of top it off with tweaks, and then you come over here for the Fringe and you're pretty much match ready to go, which is quite nice.
Yeah, yeah. But you probably hate part of your show by that.
By then you, or yes and no. See, for me, with the second show, it only all fell into place for me in New Zealand. Like it took, like them, my first few shows in New Zealand, I did them one off. So I did 4 nights at the comedy club, and they were really ropey. And then I went to Australia, did a month in Melbourne and Adelaide, and it was didn't quite fly very well. And I came back to New Zealand for a comedy festival, and it all clunked into place. And it was like, okay, this is the right show now. We've finally figured out the order. It works now. And then the moment it works, I close the book and never change it again. That's the thing. Once I've found the rhythm of it, I tend not to rework a show once I've solved it. It's a bit like a Rubik's Cube. It's like you've got to go, right, goes here, yeah, Rubik's pig. Get it in the right situation, get it in the right position, and then leave it alone because it's correct. And like I tend to know that from an audience reaction. When the audience have that weird little euphoric moment of just going, yep, that's right, leave it, don't touch it.
Do you think that's... Because for me, I my last preview in London... Mm-hmm. It went better than all the other ones, and I remember thinking, solved it. I'm nailing it. And then the third show in this run, I did two jokes the wrong way around, or the wrong way around, and it worked better. And I've carried on with that order, and it has continued to work better.
Yes, this is where I now go against what I'm saying, because only recently I did a tour into Holland, and we joked in the bar afterwards, my technician and the lighting technician there, about one of my old routines, and we threw around a joke of going, why don't I get a volunteer to do this? And it's like, I never touched this routine for 10 years because it was fine and perfect. And then the next night we tried this new joke and it added to it. It was like, okay. Yeah. So there is room. I think for me it's more about big structure rather than tweaking. Like, I'm sure tweak and change little tiny things, but for me it was the getting the order right of what I'm saying in a show. Like that overall story. Like there's in my first two shows, there are storylines there that nobody knows. Like nobody can see them because I've hidden them away in my own little way, because I keep the stories for myself because that's what makes them interesting for me. And like, I'm sure, you know, the audiences project so much of their own story into a show, and maybe for the next few shows I'll probably write something where the audience can see it a wee bit clearer, and then they can come along on the journey with me, which will be quite fun.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of, right, this is an odd question, but do you think you would have achieved where you are now if you hadn't had management, if you just carried on generating your own audience and maybe even booking your own tours?
I don't think so, not in this country. No, right. Because I think it's one of those things where you don't have the doors open, you don't have the contacts, you don't have the emails, you don't. It's also the oh God, it sounds stupid. You don't get the respect, I suppose, of going, I have an agent or doing this. Like, I remember in New Zealand, I joked at the time of having a pretend agent where I would, you know, if you wanted to book me, I'd say, yeah, just contact this email address. He books all my work, and it was going to be me. So it's just, it's easier to negotiate when it's not you. You can ask for more money. You can be a wee bit firmer. You can get everything on your rider. You can make it work. But here, I think when you're, especially within this country, you need to get television work to be seen, to be recognisable, and that's the thing. And through that, you will get snapped up by some form of management pretty quick. You can never go at it completely alone. And there will be some point where management will come along and say, we want to get you, we want you. You start getting courted. And then they start blowing smoke up your ass and promising the world to you about, we'll get you this, we'll do this, we'll do that. And that's where I think every up-and-coming comedian needs to be really careful and keep their wits about them.
What do you mean?
Like just in the sense of going, know why you're signing with an agent and what you want them to do for you, and also what your intentions are. You know, you know your goals, know what you want to do. And if being famous is one of them, then go and die. But you should, you know, you want to go, you know, you want to write books. You know, is that your goal really? You want to use comedy to be a device to get into acting. You know, if you're not recognisable as an actor, but you can be a good comedian, then suddenly you are now a comedian actor. There's people out there doing it.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah. Do you see it as like they work for you or you work for them, or
I think we both work for each other, but at the same time Like, I've been very clear with my management that if I ever decided I wanted to talk to another agent, I'd be very upfront and talk to him about it first. I would never go off and sneak behind his back. It's like a girlfriend. You're not going to go, oh, I'm going to go see, I'm seeing another agent. This is exciting. Yeah. But no, I think...
Does my hair look
all
right?
Yeah, yeah. So I think it has to be a case of going, why would I want to see another agent? It's because I would want them to offer me something else that my current agent wouldn't be able to offer me. Mm. Like, you know, anal. I'm kidding.
With a name like Gag Reflex, they are definitely offering something.
Whereas then it just comes down to a case of talking to your agent about, you know, I want to achieve this goal and this goal. But then it always comes back to the client and the performer to know exactly what you want to be doing. It's all good and well for so many agents to go, we're going to get you famous, we're going to put you on TV, you're going to be a star, you're going to make lots of money. But realistically, you're the person who's going to do it, because you're going to have to write the content, you're going to have to perform it, and you're going to have to sleep with the fact every night that you're making all your own decisions. So like, my agents will say to me, if I'm ever making a bad choice, I know I do it occasionally, actually quite a lot, my agent has a wonderful phrase which he always tells me, as your agent I can only offer you the best advice that I think is for you. And it's like, it's such a wonderful parenting way of doing it, where I just go, I totally see what you're saying and I get it, I totally see that this is the right decision, got it, it's all good. And then I can go away and think about it and go, yes, he is completely right.
Mm.
Which is, you know, 9 times out of 10 the correct way to go about it. But then it's also, he's willing to completely let me fuck it up as well. Like, there's no point he will ever say to me, you can't do that. Mm. Which is, that's also very important, because that means I still have to maintain some form of power in my own career. Mm. Otherwise I'm just handing over everything and then literally becoming a dancing monkey, which is not what I want to be.
Yeah. As you would have seen in 2005.
Indeed, five, absolutely, yeah.
But like, so this is interesting, because you see it as you still have some control over your career, but you still need them...
I'd still need them to sort it all out. That's the thing. I can only say, I want to achieve this goal and this goal, and I'm the one outlining the goals and saying, this is where we're going to go. Like, in March of last year, I rang up my agents and sort of went, right, I've had too much time on my own, I'm changing plans, I've written a whole bunch of goals, I wrote a 20-year plan of what I want to be doing with my career, and I talked them through exactly what I wanted to do and how I thought we could achieve it. And then at the end of the conversation, it went, okay, tell me all of that again. And then we just went through it all over it again, and I just sort of outlined what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go, how I saw it playing out. And then he starts then working to make that happen, and then we're sort of, that comes down to take face plans. So everything is underway, we've got the goals in sight, and we go, yeah, we can make this work.
So okay,
yeah.
20 years, is that like year by year, month by month, or is that like...
Initially, the first few years are very monthly planned out, right, and then they start sort of getting a wee bit foggier and greyer. But it always comes back to that kind of markers of the Perrier's a marker, the Royal Variety's a marker. So I can go, the first few years, I've got lots and lots and lots of markers, and then into your 10 years and your 15 years, they get further apart until eventually my final marker is to open a bookshop.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I want to do, is open a bookshop.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my end game.
As in, like, to sell your own books, or to sell... Like...
Oh, just sell books. Yeah, just that's. I think that was the thing I realised. What is my goal? My goal is to be... Because for so many performers, they always have that thing where they go, I have to perform because I know nothing else. This is all I've ever wanted to do. And it's like, yes, this is all I've ever known I want to do, but I think I would love to be in a position where I could choose not to do it. It's a mental switch to go, I know I have to perform for audiences because I love it, I love getting the kick out of it, I love creating material. And so many people say to me that I could never give this up because I go crazy. It's like, I would want to get to a position where I can go so crazy that I'm happy to give it up.
Yeah, yeah.
That I'm really comfortable to go, you know what, I'm happy to end now. And it's really nice to just go, I've done all of that with my career and now it's perfect, I can sign off on it without having the need to create it for my own benefit.
Why a bookshop?
I've already mapped it all out. It's a tiny little bookshop, because it's a bookshop with one bookcase that sells about 100 books tops, a rack of clothing that has 20 t-shirts because I like t-shirts,
right,
and a cabinet of curiosities, very small one, and I make coffee. You can have a black coffee or a white coffee. The shop is called No Parking, and you can only stay for 20 minutes and you're only allowed in once a day.
Is that all real?
That's all real. That will be real. Yeah, that's my goal.
That's amazing.
That's my biggest dream. And so that's the thing, and clearly with a business plan like that, it will never make any money.
I was going to say.
So I have to work so hard for 20 years to have enough money in the bank that I can have this failing business of a bookshop.
That's amazing.
That'd be ridiculous.
I like
yeah.
that you know.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to die on its ass, that bookshop. I know my wife and kids are going, what's Dad doing with the business? He's ruining it. I'm just there screaming at somebody, get out of the shop.
It's been 19 minutes 57.
You haven't bought anything. Get out. See you tomorrow.
So what were they like, book 20 minute slots or something?
I think so, yeah. Or you can have more people in, but when they come in, they get given a timer and then their alarm goes off and they get out.
There's
it's horrible.
There's a cat calf in London, right?
Yes, there's one here in Edinburgh now as well.
Really?
Yeah, just opened up.
The one in London, I've been told, because I've just booked in for me and my partner because she loves cats.
Yep.
And apparently you only get a certain time limit in there as well.
Yeah, you get
so
one
it
hour.
Might work.
Yeah.
20 minutes is probably too short, but you know.
20 minutes with the correct number of books, t-shirts and cabinet and a cup of coffee, a small bit of banter, you're done.
Amazing. And will they like continue to represent no parking books, or like is it like
no, I think I would just get books I like, little, you know, first editions and anything I find interesting, little,
right.
Yeah, weird little occult books and all sorts of stuff.
I just like the idea that Gag Reflex in 20 years just announced we're going into the book
going
business
into books.
We're going into books.
No, this would be my retirement scheme. This is my year. And then I start at that point
business.
My failing business is my retirement. At least I'm open about it. I know my retirement is going to die in its ass.
Most comedians have one vanity project and they all think it's going to make it, but it's nice to know, you know,
mine has died. Mine is one. Wonderful. I'm going to hemorrhage money.
Oh, amazing. Well, okay, let's end on this then. If you had... Okay, so we've already asked you what your favourite comedians are.
Yep.
What are the favourite shows you've ever seen?
Ooh. Titus Andronicus at the Globe was phenomenal. I think I liked that because it had nothing to do with comedy. and also because it was a performance that was so wonderfully stripped back and raw. It was so brutal. It was really, really good. Mm. And then to think more of sort of stereotypical comedy shows and performances like that. I'm trying to think. I see, this is the thing, I'm just starting to see more and more shows. But the problem now with seeing more and more shows is that you start seeing the structure and the skeleton of it. So you see the tricks. I'm trying to think, God. Like, in what way? Like, how long ago? Or
just... like shows that maybe made an impact on you, or that you just thought that is genius, that is something worth looking up if someone is able to find it on YouTube or whatever.
Now I feel the pressure of thinking.
Do you want to leave that one?
Yeah,
come back
no, I'm just trying to think. Yeah, give us another question. I'll think about the other show.
The next question was going to be because I always ask what books comedians have read or like have read by other performers on like either structure or about shows or about the history of it. It sounds like you might have a whole shelf of books.
I've got a couple of books. There was Diary of a Sword Swallower, which was a great book about carny freaks and whatnot. And that was a really interesting read of the insights of circus. Then the other one I read, I think it was called Escape from the Funhouse by Andy Kaufman.
Andy Kaufman.
Beautiful book.
Yeah.
Really, really lovely. I'm just trying to think now of what show, damn it. What is the show?
Do you know what's going to happen? This is going to go out and like one of your friends is going to hear it and go, what about mine?
What about my show? My show was brilliant.
Yeah.
No.
I remember you said afterwards it was
a great show.
Yeah.
That was good. Perfectly adequate. 3 stars.
it wasn't as long as last year. I remember that. I remember you said.
Trying to think of the shows that are perfect and lovely. Well, this sounds awful to say, but I would say... one of my favourite shows was actually my wife's show. She did a show called Siren, which was she's a singer, cabaret singer, and also a singer of vintage songs, but she just put together a show based on ship songs and ocean songs about the ocean, and that was the running theme. And then the collection of music was so varied, from Tom Waits to Jeff Buckley to some vintage classics as well, and it was just that was a fairly stunning show to watch. And so I'm pretty sure that'll keep going around for a while, which is quite nice.
So what's your wife's name?
Lily Lascala.
It's just so I link to everything you talk about,
Course.
I have like show notes and stuff, so it's better, because I would be looking up like someone Willis somewhere.
Lily Lascala and Siren. I'm trying to think of another good, amazing show that really blindsided me.
It's alright, you can email in.
Yeah, I'll flip it through.
And we'll do it that way. Last question then. If you had one bit of a... because the thing is... okay. Again, this is not meant offensively.
Yep. I love this. Three times now.
Three times. It's going to be like a running thing.
Yeah, this is not offensive.
It's not offensive. What you do is not, on paper, mainstream.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I imagine to get it to a mainstream audience, it will have had to there's been a lot of crashing and burning and learning back and forth. If someone else had something, because the thing is, you've got to really think this is going to work, because there's a lot of people out there who do stuff that is quote unquote not mainstream, and you have to sort of go, yeah, but it's also not funny.
You got to know it's funny.
So how did you, was there a point when you thought, I am convinced this is funny, I should carry on with it?
That's where you just, you have to have the to a degree funny bones to go, I know that this is funny. And also you ask the right people, you get the feedback to go, this is what the basic gag is. And I think you can also boil all of my jokes into just, this is the reason why it's funny. The reason why the bullfight routine in one show is funny is because I'm getting a man to do a certain silly thing, or I'm getting a woman to be a stereotypical moment here. And so that's what the joke is. It's not to do with anything of the props. So it's always going to be funny. It's like you can't get away from the fact that it's funny because for hundreds of years we've always done that in other shows with other audience members. So I'm lucky in that sense where I'm falling back on such a huge history of vaudeville and variety that I know already it's proven to work. So yeah, I'm fairly safe in that way.
Yeah. And did getting an agent make that easier for your mind to not go? Because I'm sure you had that moment where you were like, you even said you gave up in 2007. Like, everyone has that moment where they're like, is this even worth doing?
I think the giving up side of things was just, that had I had someone who I could have fully talked through the whole process of it, that would have probably helped. But I don't know, the whole, if you get an agent, that's just going to open up more work. And at the same time, you think that getting an agent means that you do less work and you have more time to write. It's like, since getting an agent, I've certainly done more work at my desk, doing more office admin and organising the business side of my life. So, that you know, it is a two-edged sword. You get an agent, you get more work, which means you do more work. So you've got to be prepared to do the work. That's the thing. A lot of people think that once you get an agent, you can sit back and go, I've got my 20 minutes, I'm sorted, I'm famous, yay. No, you've got to be prepared to really put in the hard yards.
Yeah. So if you had one bit of advice for someone who maybe thinks of themselves a bit different and they're trying to build an audience, what would you say is...
I would say that this advice goes to every point. It's just set goals. Clearly set outline plans and goals. Like, you have to go, this is what I want to do and these are my reasons for wanting to do it, and just mark it out, work backwards to go, my goal is to have to succeed in doing a show at the Edinburgh Fringe. What do I want to achieve out of it? I want 3 people to review me. I want to do this, I want to do that, and just really clearly mark it and work backwards from every single one of those points. It's like, if you want reviewers to see your show, how do you get reviewed? How do you contact reviewers? So you need to send them press releases. How do I send the best press release? Work backwards from that. Just backwards working is the best advice I can ever offer anyone of going, this is my big goal, work right backwards until you know exactly how to do it.
That was the boy. Me and Sam met up in Edinburgh, and it was one of those really nice meetups in Edinburgh where I hadn't seen him for a year, and we went like just to a park and sat, and it was so far away from pretty much all of the festival, it just felt like two people having a chat, and I really enjoyed that, and I thought it was really fun to do, and it really got my head out of the festival for a little bit, but keeping it within comedy. So I hope that came across, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you were enjoying this podcast and you would like to support me, here are some quick ways you can do it. 1, share this link with someone that you think will appreciate or value the content. Leave it a review in iTunes. Seriously, future guests are reading them, and it helps with the charts, apparently. I'm not sure how, but apparently it does. Give me a donation if you want. You can do that on PayPal via my website. You can also sign up from Patreon and donate from $1 per episode of the podcast, which is about 80p. 80p? Did you think that content was worth 80p? Then you should definitely sign up as a patron. That would really help. If you'd like to go a step further and you would like something back for your money, you can buy my book, as I mentioned before. It's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free, and it's a how-to guide for performers who want to build an audience and a community around what they do and have that audience support them through the connections and network that you create online. If you found this podcast and you're enjoying this podcast and have been for a while, the first part of the book is on how to get your free content out there and build an audience for it. The second part is seeing if they'll sustain you through things that you actually want to sell when you have something to sell on the back of the free content. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, Simon's made an audience for his podcast, I wonder how he did that. Well, it goes into detail in the book, but also I've interviewed other people who have done it much better than I have and talked to them about how they've built an audience and then asked that audience to sustain them and help them to continue creating. If you'd like to know more about that, the book is available. It's in the show podcast notes. It's also on my website at simoncane.co.uk. And yeah, it's pretty much everything. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for sharing. Thank you very much for donating, and thank you very much for buying my book if you do. I'll be back in about a week with another podcast. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.